Galatians chapter 4, from the second half of verse 12 to chapter 5, verse 1, the 17th talk in a series on Galatians, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 10, 2019, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 10, Translation Installment 4, Handout number 11, Translation Installment 5, and Handout number 12, Allegories in Galatians 4:21 to 5:1, accompany this talk.
Continuing on in the book of Galatians, we're down to part 11, paragraph 23, the second subsection of the second section of the primary argument of the letter. In the first section, he basically argued that everybody who believes in Jesus is going to be an heir to the blessing promised to Abraham. And that's what section one was basically all about. Now in section two, the point that he is making and shall continue to make is that those of us who belong to Jesus are what he calls free from the law. And we've talked about this before, but what he means by free from the law is that we are free to obey it and we are free to not obey it. Or at least we're not free to obey, we're not free to not obey all of the law, but certain portions of the law we are free to set aside. In particular, what he has in mind are all those portions of the law that instruct the Jews to be distinctive in the way they dress and eat and the festivals they keep and that kind of stuff, the very distinctive religion that the Mosaic Covenant prescribes for the people of Israel. They're free to set that aside now. And we saw last week in the first subsection, it's kind of like a child in a household who is under guardians and caretakers and tutors and nannies when they're young, when they're infants, and their whole life is governed by the instructions and the directions of their caretakers. But when they become adults, they're no longer under those caretakers. Their lives are no longer governed by what is dictated to them by the people responsible for them. And Paul said the Mosaic Covenant was like that to us Jews. When we were infants, when we were little, the Mosaic Covenant was playing the role of a caretaker, a manager, that was dictating to us and instructing us how we needed to live our lives. But should we ever become an adult, no longer does the Mosaic Covenant play that role in our life. And he identifies the coming of Jesus, the Son, as the time when Judaism moved from their infancy to their adult sonship. So now that Jesus has come, the Mosaic Covenant no longer plays that role in our life. Now, what's striking about that is, until working it through this time, I hadn't realized how in Christian interpretation of Galatians, they have typically made a big deal about how there's this break between Jews under the law and Jesus. There's this radical break. It made this huge difference. Christian interpretation has not been wrong to see that break. They're right to see that break. That's exactly what he was arguing in that last section. It made all the difference in the world when the Son came into the world. No longer was the Mosaic Covenant playing the role that it had been played before, and it's never going to play that role again, basically. So Christians have not been wrong to understand him to be saying that. Christians have tended to draw implications out of that that are not true, even at times perverse. But the fundamental insight that everything changed with Jesus is exactly right and is exactly what Paul was arguing there. So he ends that section by saying, you used to be pagans, religious pagans who believed in all kinds of gods, and you served them and sought to be right with them through your religious practices. Don't go back to that again, he said. Changing pagan religion to Jewish religion doesn't fix religion. Religion is religion, and religion is never the way that you can find approval and acceptance of God. That's just not how it works. So he says, become as I am, namely, living like free to live like a Gentile, because I became as you. I imitated your lifestyle when I was among you, because I was perfectly at liberty to do so, even as a Jew, to set my Jewish religion aside and live like you Gentiles did. I was perfectly free to do that. And so ironically, he's saying, you should feel free to live like Gentiles also, you Gentiles. So that's how he ended the last section. Now he has a parenthetical section in this next subsection where he's basically just expressing how frustrated and perplexed he is with them. This doesn't really contribute to his argument in any way. It's just kind of a parenthetical statement where he expresses himself about how I'm really frustrated with you. I'm really perplexed by you. So it's the next two paragraphs, and let me read that. In your normal Bibles, it'll be 4:12 through 4:17. You did not wrong me in any respect. You know that I proclaimed the good news to you the first time on account of a physical ailment. But this ailment, this test of you in my body, you did not look down on it, nor did you hold it in contempt. Instead, you received me as a messenger from God, as Messiah Jesus. So where is your sense of good fortune now? For I bear witness with regard to you that if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me. By embracing the truth among you, have I as a result become your enemy? They eagerly want you to join them, but it is not well. To the contrary, they wish to shut you out so that you will eagerly want to join them. However, it is a good thing to be eagerly wanted for a good reason. At all times, and not only when I am present with you, you are my children, with whom I again suffer birth pains until a complete grasp of the Messiah is formed in you. I could wish to be present with you now to change my tone because I am baffled by you. Okay, he starts off, you did not wrong me in any respect, which is just sort of out of the blue, and it's kind of, where is that coming from? Are they accusing him of accusing them of doing wrong to them? I don't think so. I think the rest of the paragraph clarifies what he means by that. Is when I came among you, I didn't meet with any animosity or enmity or contempt or disrespect. You were perfectly wonderful in your response to me. You didn't do anything harmful or in any way treat me wrong when I was among you. And we'll see what he means by that as we go on. He says, you know that I proclaimed the good news to you the first time on account of a physical ailment, but this ailment, this test of you in my body, you did not look down on it, nor did you hold it in contempt. Instead, you received me as a messenger from God, as Messiah Jesus. So where is your sense of good fortune now? For I bear witness with regard to you that if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me. Okay, we have a number of clues here that we have to put together. He talks about that he proclaimed the good news to them the first time because of a physical ailment. He talks about how he bears witness that if possible, they would have plucked out their eyes and given them to him. And then we don't have it in this part of the translation yet, but at the very end of the letter, Paul's going to take over the pen from the amanuensis, the one who's actually penning the letter. He's going to take it over, and the first thing he's going to say is, see with what large letters I am writing this, which seems to have pertained to his vision. So apparently, when he talks about a physical ailment, it's some kind of eye ailment that has affected his vision. I think that explains why he says, I bear witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me. You were so grateful when I was among you that if it were possible, you would have sacrificed your own eyes and eyesight in order to give eyesight to me. That what that doesn't explain is, you know that I proclaimed the good news to you the first time on account of a physical ailment. What's with that? I have heard a theory, I don't remember where, but I have heard a theory that makes a certain amount of sense to me. When you look at the book of Acts, the chronology is he goes from the seaport near Antioch in Syria. He goes to Crete. He traverses the whole island of Crete. When he gets to the other end of the island, he gets on a boat and goes across to what is now south central Turkey, to Perga, in a Roman district called Pamphylia. He would have gone first to the seaport, Attalia, and then would have traveled by foot to Perga, which was the main metropolitan center in the district of Pamphylia. But if you read that account, you'll notice there's no church. I'm sorry, did I say Pamphylia? Perga. If you read that account, you'll notice there's no church in Perga. He doesn't go to the synagogue in Perga. There's no record of any ministry whatsoever in Perga, which is really striking and amazing. It's not a small city. It's not a trivial omission to not bother to evangelize while you're there. So the question is, why didn't he do that? One theory is that Perga is on the coastlands of Turkey. The geology of Turkey is you have some low coastlands and then it rises quickly into very high plateau. All of the churches that he's writing to are up on that high plateau in a district called Pisidia and the one next to it. I can't remember what that is. So that's where he goes and proclaims the gospel and forms these churches. Why did he do that? The theory is that the swampy lowlands of Pamphylia is malaria-ridden, and that he may very well have contracted malaria while he was there, which potentially affects your eyesight. Can anyone vouch for that? I imagine you don't feel much like looking at anything when you have malaria, but I think one of the side effects of malaria, according to this theory anyway, is that it can damage your eyes and damage your eyesight. So in order to escape the malaria-ridden lowlands, and maybe there was some relief to be had by going into a higher elevation and perhaps a drier elevation, he travels up to Pisidian Antioch first. There's an Antioch in Syria, there's an Antioch in Pisidia. He left the Antioch in Syria, but he ends up going to Antioch in the district of Pisidia. That's where he first proclaims the gospel among these people in Galatia. Now, what he might be referring to is that might have been something of a change of plans. Maybe his plan was to evangelize in Perga and then get on a boat and travel up to, say, Ephesus, for example, and evangelize in Ephesus and basically hug the coastland and hit the major seaports along the way. Maybe something like that was his plan, but he had a little change of plans when he got malaria. So he went up into the highlands and proclaimed the gospel in Pisidian Antioch. So it could be that what he's saying is, I could have not even come to you. It could very well have been that I wouldn't have proclaimed the gospel among you, but because of a physical ailment, I did. I came to you and I proclaimed the gospel to you. Whatever this ailment was, it must have made him ugly, because he calls it a test of you in my body. That it might have affected his appearance, and it's hard to respect somebody who looks ugly, and he realizes that this was going to be a real test to them. Are you going to be able and willing to grant me the respect to listen to the message I have when I look so horrible, when my looks are horrendous? That was a test of you, he says, but you passed that test. You did not look down on my appearance, on my physical ailment. You did not hold it in contempt. Instead, you received me as a messenger from God, as Messiah Jesus. That is, you responded, as we'll see here, you responded as if it was your great fortune for me to have come to you. And you loved me, and you showed gratitude to me, a gratitude that really belongs to Messiah Jesus. You showed that gratitude toward me, the messenger of this liberation, this redemption, this salvation that comes because of Messiah Jesus. But you treated me with the gratitude that actually belongs to Jesus. But you showed me incredible gratitude because I gave that message to you. I brought that message to you. So where is your sense of good fortune now, he says? Why do you not continue to be grateful for the message that I brought to you now? That's what baffles him. For I bear witness with regard to you that if possible at the time, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me. So what's the problem? By embracing the truth among you, have I, as a result, become your enemy? Is it because I'm insisting that the message of Jesus be the true message of Jesus, and that what we understand to be the implications of the gospel of Jesus, that I'm insisting that they be the true implications of the gospel of Jesus, is that what has made me your enemy? That would be ironic. But he has no other explanation. Apparently, that's what they're responding to. They don't like the implications of the gospel as he is spelling them out to them, and so all of a sudden they have turned on him and don't trust him and respect him in the same way that they did when he first brought the gospel message to them. Now, in this next paragraph, Paul comments on the false teachers. What about these false teachers that seem to be having an impact on you? They eagerly want you to join them. The point being, they are eager for you to adopt the same mindset that they have and the same viewpoint that they have. They want you to be one of them. But it's not well, he says. To the contrary, they wish to shut you out so that you will eagerly want to join them. If I were translating it now, I think I'd translate it slightly differently. To the contrary, they are willing to shut you out to the end that you will be eager to join them. And I think what he's saying is not well is their strategy is to make you feel on the outside the circle, looking in but excluded. You're on the outside of the circle. And we all know in human psychology, we all know the force of being shoved outside the circle. You desperately want to be inside the circle. If you've never read an essay by C.S. Lewis, I think it's called The Inner Circle, something like that. He explores that dynamic and that psychology. It's a great essay. That's what Paul's talking about. Their strategy is to make clear to you, you're not one of us. You're not a real follower of Jesus. You're not an authentic follower of Jesus. You're not inside the circle of people who really know where it's at with respect to Jesus. You're second class. And when you get the message loud and clear that you're second class, one of the things that we do in response to that is, well, I don't want to be second class. I want to be first class. What do I have to do? What would I have to do to become first class? Well, you have to think like we do, teach like we do, practice like we do, be one of us. So the pressure is put on them to join in their perspective. But I think Paul's point is, look how evil it is. Their whole perspective is, you're on the outside, and they probably sincerely think that they're on the outside. You're on the outside of eternal life. You're on the outside of the blessing of Abraham. You don't get it. It's not yours. And Paul's point is, they don't really care about you. All they care about is themselves. They want you to join them, and confirm and ratify their position. That's all. That's the only thing they care about you is your vote. But they don't care about your soul. They would be willing to exclude you. They'd be willing for you to not get the blessing of Abraham and not get eternal life and go to condemnation, go to damnation. They'd be willing for that. They're making sure that you feel like you're out there because they want you to join them. That's what they're really concerned about. And he's going to contrast that with his own motives here. So they are willing to shut you out to the end that you will be eager to join them. However, it is a good thing to be eagerly wanted for a good reason, as opposed to an evil reason, a selfish reason. Now he gives his own motive. At all times, and not only when I am present with you, you are my children, with whom I again suffer birth pains until a complete grasp of the Messiah is formed in you. Now, what's motivating him? What's motivating him is the same thing that motivates a mother to want the child that is growing in her body to be safe and healthy and sound and well-formed. Paul is motivated in the same kind of way. It's them that he's concerned about. It's them as individuals that he's concerned about. He wants a full grasp of the Messiah to be well-formed in them so that they will be qualified for the blessing of Abraham, eternal life, etc., etc. Whether they validate Paul or not is really of no concern to him. He knows he's valid. He doesn't need to be validated by somebody coming along and saying, yeah, I think you're right, Paul, I believe you, I'm on your team. He doesn't need to be validated. His concern is them. You need to know this stuff. Your eternal destiny is on the line here. Your eternal well-being is at stake, and you need to know this stuff. So he says, I'm in birth pains all over again. He was while he was among them, and now that they seem to be rethinking and reconsidering and willing to depart from the gospel that he taught to them, now he's in birth pains all over again. And he will agonize until they have come to a full and complete understanding of the Messiah and all the implications of the Messiah to their lives. And then he just comments, I could wish to be present with you now and to change my tone, because I am baffled by you. So he realizes, I think, as he's writing this letter, that he's writing this letter with a certain amount of energy. The frustration is coming through, and he wishes that he didn't have to be frustrated. He'd like to change his tone. But he says, I can't help it. I am frustrated. I am totally baffled and bamboozled by how easily you have forgotten everything that I taught you and are being swept away into this other way of thinking. Okay, all that was just sort of parenthetical, him just emoting, him just expressing his puzzlement and his frustration. In the next subsection, he gets back to the argument now. This is part 12, paragraph 25 through 28. I'll read that whole thing here. Tell me, you who want to be under Torah, do you not listen to the Torah? It is in fact written that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman and one by the free woman. Now indeed, while the son by the slave woman was born to Abraham in accord with physical descent, yet the son by the free woman was born to Abraham in keeping with the promise. Here is what these things are when they have been made into an allegory. These women are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be in slavery. This one is Hagar. This Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. And she corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free. This one is our mother. Now it is written, be overjoyed, barren woman who is not bearing children. Burst out and shout, you who are not suffering birth pains, because the children of the desolate woman will be more numerous than the children of the one who has a husband. Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of the promise. But just as at that time the one who is born by way of physical descent persecuted the one who is born by way of the Spirit, so it is now also. But what does the Scripture say? Kick out the slave woman and her son. Indeed, the son of the slave woman will certainly not inherit with the son of the free woman. So then, brothers, we are not children of the slave woman, but of the free woman. The Messiah set us free from condemnation into freedom from the demands of the covenant. Keep standing firm, therefore, and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. As a young wannabe Bible student, I would come across this section and just go, whoa, what are you doing, Paul? You're embarrassing me. You're sounding like an idiot, and I'm not prepared to let you be an idiot, so what on earth is going on here? And back in those days, the whole idea of seeing types in the Old Testament and anticipations of the Messiah that you could find on every line and in every verse if you just turned it into a symbol. And I, at that point, the Bible teachers around me were kind of all in favor of doing that kind of thing, and I wasn't in any position to call them wrong. So, okay, well, maybe that's what Paul is doing here, is he's finding a symbolic meaning to the biblical text. But as I think grew, maybe I degenerated, but I think I grew as a Bible teacher over the years and came to realize that when Jesus expounded everything from Moses to the prophets on the road to Emmaus, he wasn't doing typology. He wasn't looking at every verse and every chapter and finding all kinds of symbolic meaning to the Old Testament stories and saying to them, see, that's me, that I'm that symbolizes me. That's not how he was finding himself. That would have been too cheap and easy. What he was doing is actually finding where the Scriptures, taken in their most straightforward and reasonable meaning, were talking about him and were predicting him and anticipating him in one way or the other. That's what he meant. So it's important to not look at what Paul is doing here and seeing it as some kind of validation or vindication of a typological interpretation of the Old Testament or symbolizing the stories in the Old Testament to give them a deeper meaning that is below the surface. That's not what he's doing. The other problem with this section is you don't have to look too carefully to realize, you know, when he talks about the present Jerusalem, who is the present Jerusalem in the line where he says, this one is Hagar, this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and she corresponds to the present Jerusalem? What does he mean by that? Well, the most straightforward way to take the present Jerusalem would be the whole Jewish religion and culture in Judea, in Jerusalem and in Judea. It's not really all that likely that you would use the present Jerusalem to describe the church headed up by James in Jerusalem. And for that matter, would Paul say that James and Peter and the other apostles that are in Jerusalem and the people in Jerusalem who are hearing them and believing their gospel, that they correspond to Hagar, who is in Mount Sinai in Arabia, that they're off base, that they are completely off base? Now, that would make sense in the argument if he's saying the false teachers are from them. But we already know earlier in Galatians, he makes a big point out of, I took my gospel to Peter and James and Cephas, James, somebody, John, was it? Can't remember, somebody else. But I took it to the apostles in Jerusalem, and they couldn't add a single thing to what I said. They completely agreed with me. We are exactly on the same page. He's already made it clear that he thinks he's on the same page with the other apostles. So it can't be that the present Jerusalem is the apostolic church in Jerusalem. It makes all the sense in the world that the present present Jerusalem is the unbelieving Jerusalem of Judaism at large. Judaism in that day, for the most part, had not accepted Jesus as the Messiah. They had rejected him. They didn't buy it. And they were going on their merry little way, continuing in the traditions of their elders, but practicing the religion that had been established as the Jewish religion without any regard to Jesus being the Messiah. So that's what makes the most sense here. But then that presents a problem. Why now do you have a whole paragraph about unbelieving Judaism in a letter that it has not been concerned with that at all, but has completely been concerned with supposedly believing Jews? They believe that Jesus is the Messiah. They have not rejected the Messiahship of Jesus. It's just that they think believers in Jesus should continue keeping the Mosaic Covenant. What place does describing unbelieving Judaism have in a letter that is combating believing Judaism gone awry? You follow? That doesn't immediately make sense. So I think in order to understand that, I have to propose some background to this that I think is very plausible. One of the things that would, well, and I've already described this, why do those false teachers believe what they believe? Why do they believe that as a follower of Jesus who believes that Jesus is the Messiah, I should go right on keeping the Sabbath, eating kosher, doing all the things that the Jewish religion tells me to do? Why should I live that way? Well, why not? I mean, Jesus was a Jew. Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, right? He's the Jewish Messiah. So wouldn't we expect that if God sent the Jewish Messiah into the world to fulfill his promises to the Jews, that a follower of Jesus is going to keep right on track practicing the Jewish religion of Jesus and everyone before him? I mean, duh. Of course they will. And that makes all the sense in the world unless you believe, as Paul does, that Jesus was a bombshell that blew history apart, blew history wide open, and became a watershed event that changed everything. In other words, you go from the infancy of Judaism to the adult sonship of Judaism. You've left that behind. You no longer are taking your direction from caretakers and nannies and managers. You're now an adult son, and everything is new and different. If you believe it's been that kind of watershed event that's changed everything, then you have a different perspective. But if you don't believe that, if you think that Jesus just came on and got kind of added and integrated into our Jewish religion because now he is, after all, the Jewish Messiah, you know, you don't miss a beat. You just keep on being a Jew and add Jesus as the Messiah to the mix. Then they're right. If that perspective is the right perspective, then they're right. Yeah, and we should live like Jews. So what Paul's doing here in this section, I think, is saying he's giving a nod to them on the one hand, but he's correcting them on the other hand. Here's what I mean. What he wants to maintain is, but there's really two streams within Judaism. There's two ways of being a Jew. There's two Jewish religions. So you're right. You would expect that belief in the Jewish Messiah is going to simply integrate you into a practice of the Jewish religion. That's right. But which Jewish religion? Which Jewish religion is the appropriate Judaism for a Gentile to identify with and to be connected to and to be integrated into? Which one is it? So Paul's saying their reasoning is overly simplistic. If your reasoning is simply, if Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, then being a follower of Jesus should make me a practitioner of the Jewish religion, something like that. Paul is not going to deny that outright, but he's going to say that's overly simplistic. on the one hand, yes, Jesus is clearly a part of Judaism and the Jewish religion. However, which Judaism and which Jewish religion is he part of? For there are two different manifestations of the Jewish religion. On the one hand, the manifestation of the Jewish religion that sees Messiah Jesus as the basis for being blessed with the promised blessing of Abraham. And therefore, it makes belief in Messiah Jesus the essential defining characteristic of Judaism. That's one Judaism. Pursuing that Judaism ends in one receiving the blessing of Abraham. The second manifestation of Judaism is the manifestation of the Jewish religion that sees obedience to the Mosaic covenant as the basis for being blessed with the promised blessing of Abraham, and therefore it makes obedience to the Mosaic covenant the essential defining characteristic of Judaism. That one does not end in receiving the blessing of Abraham, he's going to argue. So that's the point of this section, is to say, but there's two directions you can go here. Which Judaism do we need to be connected, do you Gentiles, as followers of Jesus, need to find your that you are related to? The Judaism that has as its essential defining characteristic belief in the Messiah? Or the Judaism that finds as its essential defining characteristic obedience to the Mosaic Law? It makes all the difference in the world which Judaism you connect with, he said. So because there are two different manifestations of Judaism, one cannot just take the essential defining characteristic of the Judaism of that day, of Paul's contemporaries, unbelieving Judaism. You can't just take Judaism as they define it, where the obedience to the Mosaic covenant is central to their identity as Jews. You can't just take that, and because Jesus, the Messiah, is a part of Judaism, you have to live like they do. That's overly simplistic, and it's false. It's wrong. Because you'd be choosing the wrong manifestation of Judaism to imitate. And that's what Paul thinks the false teachers in Galatia have done. They've simply wanted to fit in, conform, be faithful members of Judaism, but the Judaism that is all around them and that they're awash in is this unbelieving Judaism that has made the wrong thing the central characteristic of what makes a Jew, namely obedience to the Mosaic covenant. There was a time in history where that made sense, but that time has changed. And Judaism, instead of changing with that time, has continued right on the way they had always thought about the law without making any adjustments. And Paul says, but Judaism took a left turn and the Jews didn't. They went flying right on past the turn. The obvious question is, so why does he do allegory here in this context? How do we make any sense out of that? Well, first of all, we need to realize that he's not really doing allegory in two respects. He's not finding an allegory in the Genesis text. He's not discovering a deeper meaning that God had buried within the Genesis narrative. That's not what he's saying. He's not seeing something that we can't see on the surface. That's not the sense in which it's an allegory. If there's an allegory at all, it's one that Paul is creating, not one that he's discovering. You see the difference? He might be at liberty to turn something into an allegory for his own purposes and for his own ends, but he's not for a second saying, I went back to Genesis and lo and behold, it didn't mean what we always thought it meant. There's an allegory there. And God wanted us to see the allegory and recognize this much deeper meaning. That's not what he's doing. If anything, he's creating an allegory. But the second thing is, he's not even really creating an allegory. And I'm not sure if I've even translated it in the right way. What he's doing is he's basically exploring how these two women in the Genesis account, Sarah and Hagar, can be construed to be very appropriate and apt symbols for two radically different kinds of Judaism. And he just simply wants to turn these women into symbols for these two themes, these two streams within Judaism that are centered in two different covenants. So he speaks in terms of making it an allegory, but it's not an allegory like you and I would think of an allegory, because he doesn't tell a complete story. All he does is say there's Sarah and there's Hagar, and Sarah symbolizes this and Hagar symbolizes that, so there. That's not really an allegory, not a full-blown allegory. But it's allegorical in the sense that he's taking an element of a story and suggesting what it might symbolize and what it could be an appropriate symbol of. So why does he do that? Why does he resort to that? On the one hand, I don't know exactly, but once you understand what he's doing, it's not at all crazy or nuts or far-fetched or anything of the sort. He's simply taken a story that on its surface level has significance. Namely, when God came along and promised a son to Abraham and eventually made crystal clear, you're going to have a son by your wife, Sarah, and made it clear that it was the child that she had that was the child that he is promising Abraham. When he came along and did that, and then through his handmaiden, he had another son, Ishmael, one thing is crystal clear from that text. Not every child of Abraham is a child of Abraham. That is, not every child of Abraham is an heir to the blessing of promise to Abraham. Just because you are descended from Abraham doesn't put you in the running to inherit the blessing that he promised to Abraham and his seed, Abraham and his children. Because you can be descended from Abraham, but that's not it. You have to be a child of promise. You need to be a child that God had in mind as being an heir to the promised blessing in order to be an heir to the promised blessing. Just being biologically descended from him is not enough. Well, that's clear on the surface of the account of Sarah and Hagar, Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael is not a child of promise. Okay, from there then, Paul simply wants to extend that insight a little further and make a point about his present situation that he finds himself in, or the situation that all of them find themselves in at the time that he's writing this letter. Down through time, what has unbelieving Judaism done? They have defined themselves by their relationship to the Mosaic Covenant, and that covenant has become the center of their religion and the center of their identity as Jews. That's one kind of Judaism. Let's let Hagar symbolize that. Why Hagar? She's not a Jew. Why Hagar? Because Hagar represents a child of Abraham who's not a child of Abraham. A child of Abraham who doesn't stand to inherit the promises. And that's Hagar in the account in Genesis. Hagar is the one with children who don't stand to inherit the promised blessing of Abraham, not the children of Sarah, not Isaac and his offspring. So Hagar, let's let her represent to us that form of Judaism that is not going to inherit the promised blessing of Abraham. And lo and behold, why are they not going to inherit the promised blessing of Abraham? Because their very defining characteristic is that they are looking to the Mosaic Covenant to be the basis upon which God will accept them. And he says, that's not it. Never has been, never will be. That's not how we find acceptance before God. It has always been his son who has been intended to be the basis upon which people will find acceptance by God. So who are we going to have represent those people, the people that are looking to that new basis that we find in Jesus? Well, that's Sarah. So notice he identifies Hagar and Sarah as two covenants, as correlated with two covenants. One is the Mosaic covenant, and the other he doesn't name, but I would argue it could reasonably be described as the New Covenant, what Paul elsewhere calls the New Covenant, what Jeremiah calls the New Covenant. So there's the Judaism that is centered in the Old Covenant, the Mosaic Covenant, and there's the Judaism that is centered in the New Covenant. Hagar is the first, centered in the Mosaic Covenant, and Sarah is the second, centered in the New Covenant. That's all he's saying. That's not crazy. He's just saying, let's just for brevity, let's just let these women represent to us, symbolize to us this cluster of related ideas in the one case and in the other case. And what are the related ideas? I've already mentioned most of them. If you are of Hagar, you are not going to inherit the blessing, and what he adds to it, she was a slave woman. She wasn't free. And her children are born into slavery, and they are not free. So if Hagar is representing to us the Mosaic Covenant, then notice the correlation. In the Mosaic Covenant, you are not free with respect to the law. You cannot not keep it. You cannot disregard some of its requirements or some of its terms. You're bound by it. You're hemmed in by it. You're restricted by it. You've got to do what the Mosaic Covenant says. Why? Your life and destiny depends on it. Of course you have to do it. That's the only way you can find approval before God. So of course, every last little jot and tittle of that, you're going to have to take seriously and abide by it. On the other hand, the children of Sarah, who was a free woman, are free. They are not bound to the Mosaic Covenant in the same way that the children of the slave woman are. Okay, let me start now at 25:1, work my way through it, make sure I've got everything until we get to the Isaiah quote now. 25:1, tell me, you who want to be under Torah, do you not listen to the Torah? Okay, in keeping with the very spirit of this whole thing, you who want to be under Torah. And I think he's just saying, you now believe in the Jewish Messiah. Of course you want to be under Torah. Of course you want to be a part of the Jewish tradition and its history and God's instructions to the Jews and so on. Of course you do. Yeah, that's fine. But tell me, you who want to be under Torah, do you not listen to the Torah? If you want to be under Torah, though, you better pay attention. Make sure you understand what it's actually saying, not what other people are telling you it's saying. What is it actually saying? It is, in fact, written in the Torah that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman and one by the free woman. Slave woman is Hagar, free woman is Sarah. Now, indeed, while the son by the slave woman was born to Abraham in accord with physical descent, sure enough, yet the son by the free woman was born to Abraham in keeping with the promise. He's the one that God had promised to Abraham. He's the one that God had in mind when he promised him that not only would he bless Abraham, but he would bless his seed and so on. So he's the son of in keeping with the promise. Here is what these things are when they have been made into an allegory. Maybe not the best way to translate that, but when we see these two women turned into symbols, here's what it comes to. These women are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children. The two covenants I've argued are the Mosaic Covenant, wrongly understood, and the New Covenant. These women are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be in slavery. This one is Hagar. This Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and she corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. So the point that he's making here is, so when you look at Judaism today, my Gentile friends, when you look at Judaism today, what do you see? You see Hagar. Absolutely, predominantly, typically, without a doubt, the Judaism that you see when you look around in the world today are people who are looking to the Mosaic Covenant to be the basis of their approval in the eyes of God. No question about that. I acknowledge that. So she corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. She doesn't have the option of not obeying the Mosaic Covenant. But the Jerusalem above is free. This one is our mother. Now it is written, "Be overjoyed, barren woman who is not bearing children. Burst out and shout, you who are not suffering birth pains, because the children of the desolate woman will be more numerous than the children of the one who has a husband." What does he mean by the Jerusalem above is free? Okay, he's not thinking metaphysically, there's some Jerusalem in the sky. That's not what he's doing. He recognizes that there's a Jerusalem found in the prophecies that is a very, very different place from the Jerusalem down in Judea as he's writing this letter. It's going to be a radically and fundamentally different Jerusalem. He calls it the Jerusalem above because it's the Jerusalem that God is going to bring into being. The above just refers to its divine origins, I think. There's a Jerusalem with divine origins that is going to come into existence. That one is free. It's what in Hebrews, when in Hebrews 11, when he's talking about Abraham, who is looking for a heavenly city whose foundation is... Shouldn't start it if you can't finish it. You know, he says something interesting there. But there's a heavenly Jerusalem that he's referring to in Hebrews 11. Same Jerusalem is here. The Jerusalem above is free. This one is our mother. Now it is written, "Be overjoyed, barren woman who is not bearing children. Burst out and shout, you are not suffering birth pains, because the children of the desolate woman will be more numerous than the children of the one who has a husband." Okay, he quotes a section out of the end of Isaiah. And what's interesting is the way he's interpreting Isaiah. I don't know if Isaiah's brilliant or Paul is brilliant, but somebody's brilliant here. The way to understand both Isaiah and what Paul is saying in this argument is to realize that Isaiah has created a kind of parable or a kind of metaphor in his prophecy where you have two women, a woman who is barren and a woman who has a husband who's producing a lot of children. And those women in Isaiah are themselves symbols. The women symbolize faithless, unbelieving Judaism and faithful, believing Judaism. As Isaiah is writing this, he's looking back on history and recognizing that the faithful Judaism, faithful, obedient Judaism, that is barren. There ain't no such Jews. I don't mean absolutely, but they are relatively few and far between. That Judaism is barren. The other Judaism has many, many, many children. But the Isaiah prophecy is talking about the great reversal that's going to happen, right? Be overjoyed, barren woman. Who is this woman? Well, it's just an abstraction. It's just a symbol. But be overjoyed, this woman who would give birth to individuals who are obedient to God, who are faithful to God, who trust in his promises and so on. Be overjoyed, barren woman, who is not bearing children. Burst out and shout, you who are not suffering birth pains, because the children of the desolate woman will be more numerous than the children of the one who has a husband. So what is he saying? There's going to come a time in history when God comes along and keeps his promises, where Judaism is no longer going to be defined by its faithlessness, its disobedience, its rejection of the Messiah, its dependence upon the Mosaic Covenant, if even that, to be the basis for acceptance by God. But Judaism is now going to be characterized by faithfulness to God, by obedience to God, by trust in God, by accepting his Messiah, belief in his Messiah, and all that goes with that. And they are going to be numerous. If you go back to that Isaiah account and read it, it's basically describing God filling the land with the children of this woman. The land is going to be filled up with the children of this woman who had been desolate and barren, but no more. And she should break forth and shout for the numerous children that are going to come from her. That's what he means in the verse just preceding it. This is our mother. Well, who's the this is our mother? Well, in syntactically, it best fits with the Jerusalem above. Well, the Jerusalem above is free. This Jerusalem is our mother. That is, those of us who believe in the Messiah, Jews or Gentiles, this Jerusalem is our mother. And that's the Jerusalem that was being described in Isaiah as the barren woman who should burst out and shout because her children are more numerous than the children of the woman who has a husband. That's the Jerusalem of this present day. The Jerusalem of this present day are numerous, but the day is going to come where they will be virtually non-existent. And the Jerusalem in the future is going to be filled up with these Jews who identify with God through his Messiah, basically. Now, why is that important to his argument? Because in terms of the Gentiles' perception, as they look out at the Roman Empire and every little pocket of Jews that they see in the Roman Empire, it sure looks like Judaism is centered in the Mosaic Covenant. And Paul's saying, yeah, that's what you see. But Isaiah predicted that Judaism is not going to go on existing. The day is going to come when all things are set right and God has made his people truly his people, when that will not be Judaism any longer. Judaism will be, the Jerusalem from above is free. It will be free from the Mosaic Covenant in exactly the way that Paul is advocating for freedom from the Mosaic Covenant. And I'll just remind you, he's not advocating for the position that it is somehow evil to obey the Mosaic Covenant. That's not what he means by free. What he means is you don't have to keep every little religious jot and tittle in the Mosaic Covenant if you have good reasons not to. If there's other considerations, if there's other things at play that make it problematic for you to be a Jew who's meticulously practicing the Judaism of the Mosaic Covenant. But in other circumstances, what's a Jew to do? In other circumstances, of course you'll keep the covenant because you're a Jew, and that's what Jews do. God made this covenant with you, and he told you to do these things and live this way and look this way and so on. Nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. But don't be telling Gentiles they have to do that, because that has nothing to do with what's ultimately important to them, and it has nothing to do with what's ultimately important to you either. So don't be telling them that they have to live that way. They and us are free to disregard certain elements of the Mosaic Covenant when it doesn't fit with our relationship to Jesus, the Messiah. Because that's the center of my Judaism. That's what directs and governs and dictates what I do as a Jew now, not the Mosaic Covenant. So if my obedience to Jesus makes it necessary or important or valid for me to set part of the law aside, then that's what I'll do. That's the freedom that he's talking about. Okay, now you brothers, like Isaac, are children of the promise. So we stand to inherit the blessing of Abraham, eternal life, because we are just like Isaac. Now he's talking to the Gentiles here. Now you brothers, like Isaac, are children of the promise. But just as at that time the one who is born by way of physical descent persecuted the one who is born by way of the Spirit, so it is now also. What he's talking about is in the Genesis account, if you went back and read that, Ishmael begins to hassle Isaac and gives him a bad time. He calls it persecutes him. He starts hassling him. Sarah gets fed up with it and goes to Abraham and said, Ishmael is hassling Isaac. I want you to do something about it. And Abraham's kind of reluctant. It's his child. What is he going to do? And God comes along to him and says, well, Abraham, throw him out. I'll take care of him. Don't worry about him. I'll take care of him, but throw him out. Ishmael is not going to inherit the blessing. That belongs to Isaac, not to Ishmael. So no longer consider him to be a part of your line. Just kick him out. So just as Ishmael hassled Isaac, you're going to find Jews of various persuasion hassling you Gentiles. That's going to happen. But you have to keep in mind, keep in perspective, what was true of Ishmael and Isaac is true of them and you. You are an heir to the promises. They aren't. So what does the scripture say? Kick out the slave woman and her son. Indeed, the son of the slave woman will certainly not inherit with the son of the free woman. We are heirs of the blessing. The free woman is our mother. We're going to get eternal life. They are not. I think he's only saying that by way of reassurance. It's not practical advice. I mean, how do you kick them out? I mean, we can't practically kick them out, but we can disregard their taunting and their pressure and their teaching and their point of view. We can disregard it. Why can we disregard it? Because what they're saying has nothing to do with how you get the blessing of Abraham. I get the blessing of Abraham as a child of the free woman. So then, brothers, we are not children of the slave woman, but of the free woman. The Messiah set us free from condemnation into freedom from the demands of the covenant. It's literally, the Messiah set us free into freedom. And that's not exactly clear, but given the context of his argument, what he has to be saying is, the freedom that the Messiah set us into is freedom from condemnation. We are free from the condemnation to death. We have been granted eternal life and freed us from our slavery to condemnation that we were in before we came to Jesus. So the Messiah set us free from condemnation into freedom from the demands of the covenant. I mean, that's a direct contradiction to everything the false teachers are saying. They would say the Messiah set us free from condemnation into obedience to the Mosaic covenant, or something to that effect. They would expect that the natural outgrowth of being free from condemnation by the Messiah would be that we would get right in there and all the more diligently keep the Mosaic covenant like they're going to do. But Paul's point is to directly contradict that. No, the Messiah set us free from condemnation into freedom from the demands of the covenant. We're no longer slaves of the covenant. We're free from the covenant. I should say no longer. The Gentiles never were, but they are free into that freedom that the Messiah spells for everybody. Keep standing firm, therefore, and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. So he's saying, hold your ground. Don't be pressured into joining the ranks of these false teachers who are encouraging you to keep the Mosaic covenant and whatnot. Don't be pressured into it. Stand firm. And know what's true. Know what the real implications of the gospel are. And hold your ground. Do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. That goes back to paragraph 22. Remember in paragraph 22, he says, you used to be pagans, and when you were pagans, you were enslaved to various gods, however you were, whatever they are, but you were in slavery to them. And what he meant by that is you were bound and without option but to serve them through various religious practices and various religious rituals. So when he says, be subject again to a yoke of slavery, don't go back to the same old religion that you escaped from your polytheism and your polytheistic worship. Don't become religious all over again like you were back then. Belief in the Messiah is a whole new gig. It's not a religion. It's not a new religion. It's an entirely different basis for relating to God. Haven't left you a lot of time. Questions or comments?
It almost seems like Paul just beat this into the ground. If you go back and read the story, that God promised Abraham that he would get an heir from his own body, I almost got the feeling that his own body included Sarah in the first announcement. Maybe not. But when Ishmael was born, it says that Hagar began to despise her mistress. And it sounds like Hagar had laid claim to the promise because of the part she played in bringing about a son. Hmm. And so Paul, the only metaphor he had to make was, it's not by your works that the promise is delivered. It's delivered by God himself delivering the promise.
Right.
And he could have just stopped right there.
Yeah.
But he goes on and on and on. It just seems he really overdid it. He could have said, so the point is, go ahead and keep the law, but don't ever believe that you get the blessing of God because of the works of keeping the law. Your efforts mean nothing. I mean, he could have done the whole thing in like three sentences.
Where was the Apostle Logan when we needed him?
You feel it, right?
Yeah.
But is there something about the Gentiles here?
Well,
that he's saying they should know better. You should know better.
The issues involved here are incredibly, incredibly subtle. So the reason he's beating it into the ground is he's trying to bring what's subtle out and make it clear to us. I mean, once we've become clear, it's easy. But the problem is, how many Christians have read Galatians and they still don't get it? They're still making huge mistakes about how this all fits together and what this is all about. It's because he's making very, very subtle points.
Neither Ishmael nor Isaac could not be Abraham's son.
Say that again.
Neither Ishmael nor Isaac could choose to not be Abraham's son. But Isaac could not claim the promise because he had nothing to do with becoming Abraham's son. I mean, it's John 1, 17? For as many as he gave authority to, they shall become of God, not because of the works, but because of the promise of God.
You're collapsing several different verses.
That's in a nutshell.
Yeah. Right. But the reason that's so clear to you is because that's clear to you. But take those same passages and give them to somebody else and they're going to understand them very differently. And they're going to come up with all kinds of crazy theologies and all kinds of crazy doctrines and ideas out of those very same verses. So he's not pounding into the ground. He's just working overtime to try to be as clear and as careful and as thorough as he can possibly be.
It's like an evil Jedi mind tricks being played on him. This is not the faith you're looking for. It's just like,
okay, nothing. Did you notice that he talks about Mount Sinai in Arabia? I find that fascinating. The most straightforward explanation of that is that there is a theory afloat today that is getting more and more allegiance that Mount Sinai was in Arabia. And so if by Arabia Paul means what we mean by Arabia, if that's what he means, then this would be good early evidence that the Jews knew that Mount Sinai was in Arabia.